Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, March 8th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from the Joint Replacement Center at Adirondack Health in Saranac Lake, providing tailored orthopedic procedures and rehabilitation to residents of Northern New York. Better health, better lives. AdirondackHealth.org. March is National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Joining us for Medical Monday today is Dr. Noor Parsa of Albany Medical Center. She's on the line to answer your gastroenterology questions. If you do have a question, give us a call now, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Noor Parsa and your questions coming up after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. March is National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and joining us for Medical Monday today is Dr. Noor Parsa of Albany Medical Center. Dr. Parsa is a gastroenterologist at Albany Med, where she treats adults with general gastrointestinal conditions and disorders, including celiac disease, irritable bowel syndrome, inflammatory bowel disease, and diseases of the esophagus, including GERD. She also performs endoscopies and screenings for colon cancer. Dr. Parsa completed fellowship training in gastroenterology and hepatology at Albany Med. She completed residency training in internal medicine at the University of Arizona, where she also earned her medical degree. To be part of our conversation today, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Noor Parsa, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and aside from the general push to get people tested, what else do you hope to get across to the general public?
So I think overall the most important message is just fully understanding how serious colorectal cancer is, especially not just in the United States, but globally. In the U.S., it's the third leading cause of cancer-related deaths in both men and women. So, you know, I think the importance of screening and preventative measures is key in our conversation today, especially since colorectal cancer is being diagnosed at an earlier age. And the most recent guidelines do recommend screening starting at age 45, which is 5 years less than the standard 50 years of age, which was the case a few years ago.
And based upon what science are we moving that up 5 years?
So there has been increased incidence of colorectal cancer in younger population. The reason for it is thought to be multifactorial, whether that's environmental or, you know, due to dietary changes, the Western diet, et cetera. But interestingly, as far as the younger population, the cancer is thought to be more frequently identified in the left side of the colon, whereas in the older population, it's more frequent in the right side. Either way, the best way to diagnose it would be with direct visualization with colonoscopy. So that's part of the argument, is that we're just seeing it in a younger population.
Some of the cancers that we discuss on this program appear to be, I'm not a doctor, but they appear to be much more difficult to find. Pancreatic cancer, for instance, you often find it when it's very late in the game. Colorectal cancer, however, is a different animal completely, right?
Yeah, so with any type of malignancy, whether it's related to the gastrointestinal tract or pulmonary, some of the alarm features to look for include unintentional weight loss, early satiety, just, you know, paying attention to your body, talking to you. Those subtle symptoms sometimes can mean something so much more, you know, serious. So with colorectal cancer specifically, some of the signs to be on the lookout for would include, you know, blood in your stool. It could be bright red blood or even dark black, you know, maroon colored stools. Unintentional weight loss is, of course, one of the bigger alarm symptoms. but also changes to your stool caliber. So if you're seeing that, you know, the size or shape of your stool is much different than baseline, if, you know, you're not having your regular bowel movements, if you're more constipated than usual, any types of those changes are something to be on the lookout for. Your body talks to you through different ways, your stool being one of them. So if your stool looks different, if the color is different, if the size and shape is different, those are all, you know, signs that your body is telling you that something's not right.
We're joined today on this Medical Monday by gastroenterologist Dr. Noor Parsa of Albany Medical Center. And we'll start with a few emails here that came in before the show started, and then we'll hit the phones. And the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Parsa, this one is from SJ in Troy. SJ writes, I tested negative for celiac, but find my digestive troubles are reduced to almost nothing when I don't eat gluten. Should I be tested again? Either way, I'm avoiding gluten with much success. And that's from SJ in Troy.
Right. So thank you for that wonderful question. As far as testing for celiac disease, there's a few steps to the process. So one would be serologic tests. We would check for antibodies. One of the gold standard means of testing for celiac disease is to do an upper endoscopy evaluation with biopsies of the small intestine, specifically the first part of the small intestine known as the duodenum. And with that evaluation, if any of those tests come back positive, then we can, you know, sort of further lean towards a diagnosis of celiac disease. Now, the key thing is if a patient's already on a gluten-free diet, then those tests are not really sensitive because they're not being exposed to gluten, which they potentially have an allergy to. Having said that, even if a patient was not gluten-free and went through all those testing modalities and everything still came back negative, but they're still finding a benefit from being gluten-free, they could have something that we call gluten sensitivity, where they're not necessarily, you know, in the category of having celiac disease, but overall their body just does better on a gluten-free diet. So, you know, if the patient is clinically doing better on a gluten-free diet, then I would say to go ahead and continue that.
We're joined today by Dr. Noor Parsa of Albany Medical Center. This email from Tom in Niskayuna. Tom writes, my wife has had ulcerative colitis for over 5 years, a severe case. So far, infusions of Remicade have not helped much, and now infusions of Entyvio are helping only a little. The question is, what other treatments are available? Is surgery the last option on the list? And that's from Tom in Niskayuna.
Thank you, Tom, for that wonderful question. So inflammatory bowel disease is an umbrella term that encompasses both ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. It's, you know, it can be a very difficult disease to treat. However, with the newer biologic treatments that are available, there have been increased success with treating inflammatory bowel disease overall. Now, a lot of patients do develop adverse reactions or develop antibodies to Remicade, also known as infliximab. And in that case, usually we try to see if the patient would do better on another type of medication or biologic or infusion therapy in a different category. And that's probably why, you know, your wife was started on Entyvio. Now, I don't know how long your wife has been on Entyvio, but typically it would entail, you know, having a few doses before we can say that she has, you know, truly failed the Entyvio. Surgery is usually a last resort. There's a few factors that go into a clinician deciding on if the patient ultimately needs surgery. That would be an extensive discussion to have in you know, face-to-face in clinic with both the gastroenterologist and, if needed, with the surgeon in clinic. But I would say at this point, you know, there should be a couple other options before the conversation for surgery is considered. So hopefully we're not at that step yet with your wife, but I think there would be a lot more information required before I could further comment there.
Okay, Dr. Parsa, one more email, and then we'll take a quick break and then go to the phones at 800-348-2551. This one is from Doug. And Doug writes, should all African Americans start screening for colorectal cancer at 45, men and women? Is it covered? Who else starts early? And that's from Doug.
Thank you, Doug, for that wonderful question. So as of the most recent guidelines through the United States Preventative Task Force, the current guideline is that adults age 45 and older should be getting screening, routine screening for colorectal cancer. Now, each case could be different if, you know, the patient has a history of inflammatory bowel disease or if there's a significant family history. Those would be, you know, case-by-case situations where we would consider, you know, potentially earlier screening or surveillance colonoscopy. But for the standard patient undergoing routine colorectal cancer screening or being given a recommendation to undergo screening, the current guideline is age 45 and older, and insurance companies are covering that because that's the most recent accepted guideline.
We're joined today by Dr. Noor Parsa of Albany Medical Center, and we'll get to your calls in just a moment. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. Noor Parsa of Albany Medical Center. Dr. Parsa is a gastroenterologist at Albany Medical Center. And let's go to the phones. Jim in Simsbury, Connecticut. Jim. Oh, Jim, that's a bad start. Your phone sounds like it's falling apart. Go ahead.
Well, no. Characteristically, and thinking about this program, I am doing some home plumbing.
Ah, all right. Very good. Go ahead.
Okay. I have actually two questions. One is, in a standard screening colonoscopy a number of years ago, I was told I had Crohn's disease. Oh, so it was an incidental finding. I didn't have any indications of that. And I started taking these big old black pills and everything like that. And a few years later, I had another one. They said, no, you don't have Crohn's disease. Well, that's good. Said, come back in 5 years. I said, yeah, since it was an incidental finding, I'd rather come back in 3, which I did. Again, no indication, all right? And so my question is, should I stay with 3 years because it was an incidental finding, or should I go to 5 years, okay, which is the normal guideline, I think. And then my second question is, all my life, I have had, you know, kind of loose bowels during the summer and all that. And, you know, I thought, well, that's just the way I'm built. My family physician, for other reasons, decided I didn't have enough vitamin D. And so I started taking vitamin D. And again, without going into details, things are just what they should be. And so my two questions are the business of go to 3 years for screenings, or 5. And the second question is, does vitamin D have that effect?
Okay. Dr. Parsa.
Okay, thank you for that question. I'm not sure I fully understood the second question in that. What was the question about the vitamin D?
Does vitamin D have an effect on bowel movement characteristics?
Okay. Got it. All right. Thank you. Thank you so much for the wonderful questions. So as far as a diagnosis of Crohn's, there's a few things we're looking at. First of all, we're looking at if the patient is having symptoms. So from what you were describing, it sounds like at baseline, you do have loose stools. Crohn's disease would, you know, as you know, require colonoscopy. Classically, Crohn's disease is known as a disease that likes to target any part of your GI tract. So that's from the mouth to the anus. It can target any part of your GI tract and likes to skip cause skip lesions. So you might have areas of your GI tract that are completely normal, and then some areas that are involved. Crohn's is a chronic inflammatory granulomatous disease. So that's one of the ways that we differentiate it from ulcerative colitis under a microscope when we're looking at biopsies of the colon, for example, or biopsies of the stomach. Sometimes we'll see these inflammatory collections known as granulomas. So if a patient is having loose stools, one of the differentials would be inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's falling under that category. As far as the screening intervals for patients with inflammatory bowel disease, if a patient is doing well, they're clinically what we call in remission. So they don't no longer have the loose bowel movements. You know, they're not having any extra intestinal manifestations. So with inflammatory bowel disease, something else we worry about is, you know, is the patient doing okay as far as their joints? Are they having any skin manifestations? Are they having any vision involvement? Is their vision okay? Because it can target other parts of your body as well. If the patient is doing well, whether they're on medication or not, then we would recommend intervals of, you know, gaps of about 2 years, depending on how long the patient has been diagnosed with the Crohn's. Now, it seems like there was a little bit of ambiguity in terms of, you know, with your first colonoscopy, you were told that you had Crohn's disease. With the second one, you were told that you weren't, that you didn't have the Crohn's. There would be a few other things that I would like to look at. So, you know, vitamin D level patients with inflammatory bowel disease are known to have low vitamin D levels. Just overall, the absorption of vitamin D is less. The absorption of calcium is less. So that's something we see in a lot of our patients with Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. They have low vitamin D. A lot of patients with Crohn's disease will have low vitamin B12 levels as well. I would recommend checking some blood inflammatory markers, an iron panel. There would be a few other things in the workup that would help the clinician sort of confirm a diagnosis of Crohn's disease if that is what you have. As far as the vitamin D affecting bowel movements, that's not something that I've heard of. The vitamin D would, you know, help with absorption of the vitamin, because at baseline you're not really absorbing the vitamin D as well as you should be. So it's sort of supplementing that, supplementing the calcium absorption. But generally, vitamin D shouldn't have too much of an effect on, you know, the caliber of your stools being very loose or better formed.
Well, thank you for the call. Dr. Noor Parsa of Albany Medical Center joins us. The number is 800-348-2551. Emily is in Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Hi, Emily. You're on.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Dr. Ray. I'm the Emily that bumped your show a year ago, that science project show.
Oh, okay. Very good. Well, you're on.
Well, hopefully I won't bump anything off. Hi, Doctor. I actually just went to the doctor this morning because I've gone from having very regular bowel movements to not much. And he listened to my belly and said, oh, I hear sounds. So he felt good about that and just, you know, continue with the Benefiber and, you know, probiotic. And so I have been living with someone. My husband has gone through many surgeries, colon rectal cancer, stage 4, since 2013. So I'm sort of in a slightly anxious state right now, as a feeling the same things that he's been going through for almost 7 years. So I'm doing the Benefiber. I just did my second dose of it today. This just started yesterday, and I've been a very regular person. You know, so I'm concerned. I also, just one other little bit of my history, 3 years ago, after a very stressful time, my sister had just died, I ended up in the hospital with ischemic colitis. So I'm just, you know, I'm just wondering why this came on so suddenly, you know, and why I'm really just evacuating very little amounts of bowels, you know, movements.
Okay.
So,
Dr. Parsa.
He didn't give me an answer today, the doctor I saw. So, do you have any answers?
Oh, I think we lost. Actually, you know, Emily, you seem to be very bad luck here, because the doctor was bumped here as
as
you were asking the question. But we will endeavor very quickly to get the... Oh, my heavens. To get the,
what is it with me?
You know what? You're extraordinarily bad luck on this program, but that doesn't mean we don't love
you.
Oh, no. No, you're okay.
Oh, no.
What? Now, you went through a very detailed list of issues. I am hoping... Now, I heard the phone drop as you were ending it. Okay. So I think the doctor will have the answer. If you want to hang with me for just a moment... We'll try to get the doctor back on the line. So, I mean, do you have this problem when you talk to people on the phone that all of a sudden everything goes haywire?
No. It's only with you.
No,
I mean, not you, but
yes. No, I understand.
Your radio station.
All right, so we're gonna give the doctor one more second here because I would like her to be able to follow up with you and ask any follow up questions. So I think we have the doctor.
Hi,
on the line.
I'm back on.
Oh, hello, Dr.
Yeah,
Parsa.
Not sure. I'm not sure what happened there.
That's quite all right. You know, Emily.
I'm a jinx.
She's a carrier, and so anyway.
I'm a jinx.
Emily,
I'm sorry.
Did you hear Emily's question?
I did. Okay. I did. And I had a couple follow-up questions in that. If you could just clarify as far as how long this has been going on.
Just yesterday it started, Doctor.
It started yesterday.
Just,
okay. Normally you have regular bowel movements, and since yesterday you've not had a bowel movement?
Not something that's normal, no. Just, you know, a lot of gas and a little bit of, you know, liquidy, but also solid movements. But a lot of gas and, you know,
okay.
Uncomfortable
any
in the
nausea?
Belly? No.
Okay.
No. But did you hear the ischemic colitis part like 3 years ago?
I did not.
Okay.
No.
Why don't you recap that, Emily?
I had ischemic colitis after a very stressful time after my sister died, and like a week later I ended up in the hospital. Bleeding rectally, and, you know, thank goodness my gastro doctor was on it and said, go to the emergency room, because, you know.
Of course.
Nothing was removed, nothing, you know, just over, you know, 2 nights in the weekend. It was like a weekend vacation.
So, I mean, as far as stressful life events, that can definitely change the pattern of your bowel movements. So some patients under stress will develop looser bowel movements. Others will develop more, you know, of a constipated type of clinical picture. But as far as your history of the ischemic colitis, classically ischemic colitis is secondary to, you know, some lack of blood flow to your colon. So, you know, maybe at that time you were severely dehydrated, or a lot of times in the hospital we'll see patients who are on chronic medication for blood pressure. And if that drops their blood pressure too much, they can develop ischemic colitis and, you know, those classic symptoms that you were describing, such as, you know, cramping abdominal pain in addition to blood in the stool. So as far as, you know, your current symptoms, you know, it sounds like, you know, you have a lot of good reason to be under stress. It's not been very long. So I think, you know, generally in the setting of constipation, I encourage my patients to try their best to keep well hydrated, try to move around. Our gut is very innervated. It likes movement. So, you know, trying to be as physically active as possible, which is hard to do in this, you know, day and age of a pandemic. But now that the weather's getting better, trying to get in, you know, 30 minutes of walking even is something that would make your bowels more regular.
We have a big backyard, and I have a hula hoop.
Ah.
Oh, perfect.
Well,
perfect.
There you go.
Then that would be wonderful.
Maybe I should do that.
I think, but if you continue to have the constipation, if you feel like you're not passing gas, if, you know, you're, if this continues in the next few days, then definitely speak to your primary care physician, revisit this issue, and it would warrant, you know, further evaluation with, like, an abdominal x-ray.
Emily, thank you so much for hanging around there. And Dr. Parsa, thank you for getting right back on the line.
Yes.
And this happens from time to time. You're doing very well. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros.
Thank you.
Jim, you're on.
What is the cause of Borgulis, and do pre and probiotics have much effect on it?
I'm sorry. Do you mind repeating that question? I didn't quite get it.
What is the cause of Borgulis, and do pre and probiotics have much effect on it?
What's Borgulis?
Borgemus. Okay, so are you talking about the clinical symptoms of just having loud gaseous sounds coming from the abdomen? So as far as the cause of it, so a lot of times patients with irritable bowel can have those types of symptoms. Do you have regular bowel movements?
Yeah.
So you go to the bathroom every day?
Yeah.
And your bowel movements are well formed?
Yeah.
Okay. Are you on any laxative therapies?
No.
Do you do any over-the-counter laxatives? Okay. You know, I've had a lot of patients complain about this. Sometimes avoiding lactose-containing products can help prevent that. Have you tried that? Are you lactose-free?
I don't think I have any real problems with it.
Okay. Okay. Do you, I mean, are you lactose-free, or do you consume lactose on a daily basis?
Yeah, I drink a little milk.
In the morning?
Afternoon, usually.
Afternoon, okay. Have you noticed a pattern between your food and when you develop your symptoms?
Well, I just got thinking about maybe starting on green beans. Maybe the fiber in that might be affecting it.
Okay. So, I mean, there are a few things that can exacerbate gas or bloating of the GI tract. A lot of times, you know, aside from, recommending something like simethicone or Gas-X, there's a diet called a low FODMAP diet, spelled F-O-D-M-A-P. And basically the ideology for that diet is there's some naturally occurring sugars in certain foods, and some of those sugars can exacerbate bloating symptoms. So that would be something to consider here, in addition to, you know, if lactose could be exacerbating your symptoms. The probiotics could help. Have you tried that? Have you tried taking a probiotic?
Really?
Okay. But nothing like an over-the-counter probiotic?
No.
Okay. It would be worthwhile trying it, even though, I don't think that would help with the gas per se. Everyone has different symptoms when they develop gas and bloating. So I would start off first with some dietary measures, see, you know, if you feel like the green beans are exacerbating your symptoms, or see if it is the lactose, sort of starting off from there and seeing if you have any improvement with avoiding food triggers.
Jim, thanks a lot. Good luck with the gas. Let's go to Kathy in Colony. Kathy, you're on.
Oh, hello. Thank you for the call.
Oh, you're welcome.
I want to talk about, if I can, acid reflux.
Sure.
When I was younger, I'm 65 now, but when I was younger, I was diagnosed with GERDs, and I did, you know, take some medication for maybe a year, but I stopped. I'm guilty about eating bad foods like tomato sauce or chocolate, but I don't really think I have a problem. Sometimes I'll wake up with a sore throat, but I am also guilty about not raising my bed up high. So I am going to try to do that and get some extra pillows or something. But my main question is, and it happens every once in a while, doctor, and it really scares me. I know I should go to a doctor, but I don't want to. When I'm eating, if I'm maybe eating fast or something, I'll swallow, and I feel that go down as slow motion and a little painful. And then, yeah, it will pass after a while. But what is that? It
wonderful
only happens
question.
Every once in a while.
Yeah. Yeah, no, thank you so much. That's an excellent question, and I have a lot of patients who present with very similar complaints. So just to give a little bit more of a background to the audience and acid reflux. So acid reflux is basically, as far as the approach to managing it, a combination of medications and lifestyle measures are key. So you already described a few lifestyle measures that you're aware of, such as elevating the head of your bed when you go to sleep at night, avoiding, you know, the trigger foods like tomato-based products, chocolate, peppermint. I tell my patients basically anything that tastes good can potentially give you acid reflux. So as far as your symptoms, so it sounds like, you know, clinically, it sounds like you're having what we call dysphagia, where, you know, you can feel the food almost kind of get stuck as you're swallowing. And a lot of times...
How do you say that word?
Dysphagia.
How do you say that word you just said? D-E-S-A-N?
Oh, how do you spell it? D-Y-S-P-H-A-G-I-A. Dysphagia.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So a lot of times patients with uncontrolled acid reflux, you know, if you have a lot of irritation in the esophagus, food can get stuck. So it's very important to try and control the acid reflux if, in fact, that is what you've been diagnosed with. Usually patients with acid reflux would benefit from having an upper endoscopy at some point in time, especially if they, you know, like in your case where you are having symptoms of dysphagia and difficulty swallowing, that right there would be an indication to take a look with a scope and just, you know, make sure everything looks okay. Generally, you know, something that I would like... I'm sorry?
Can that happen, but it's not anything serious? I mean... It only happens once in a blue moon.
I mean, definitely patients can have dysphagia, and it's nothing serious, but we wouldn't know unless we did direct visualization and took a look with, you know, a camera scope. Are you having, like, any unintentional weight loss, any blood in the stool?
No. I mean, I have lost weight a few years back, but I think I just because I don't eat as much, but... and I don't raise my head up. Is it a must? I get that head raised up when I sleep.
So I think it definitely helps because, you know, part of the you know, pathophysiology of acid reflux is I'm trying to not use very like high tech medical terms here, but basically between the esophagus and stomach, you have like a tight area that separates the acid in the stomach from refluxing back into the esophagus. And over time that gets looser. So acid can reflux back into the esophagus much easier. And when you're lying flat, that's going to make your stomach and your esophagus in a flat, even plane. And so the acid can come up much easier. So sort of kinking yourself with a couple more pillows will prevent that from happening more frequently while you're sleeping. Acid reflux seems like it's, you know, very benign, but it does damage over time. So if you're having uncontrolled reflux in the esophagus for years and years, that can lead to cancer. Uncontrolled reflux can lead to things like pneumonia, pneumonitis, a lot of ENT disease as well. So, you know, with your symptoms of difficulty swallowing, I think it would be to your benefit to have an upper endoscopy.
Dr. Noor Parsa joins us on this Medical Monday. We'll take a quick break here. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. The number is 800-348-2551. Gastroenterology today with Dr. Noor Parsa of Albany Medical Center. And we go to Kingston. And Hank, you're on the line.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call. I really appreciate it.
You bet.
I listen to this channel all the time. I mean, I listen from the morning to night, and it's just outstanding.
Well, thanks.
My situation, doctor, is probably for the last few months, whenever I eat a dairy product in the morning, like I could have like a bread or a bagel with a cheese omelet, you know, it goes right through me within an hour. And it seems like nothing's changed. It's doing the same thing. Is this something that I'm eating? I shouldn't be eating the dairy product so much? Or could it be I do take Eliquis, I do take that on a daily basis, but that's where I'm at during the course of the day. And sometimes lunchtime I have an issue, but not all the time.
Thank you for the great question. So just to clarify, are you having loose stools?
Only in the morning and sometimes at lunch after lunch.
Okay, so it is loose stool. Do you feel like when you take lactose-containing products, that's when you have the symptoms most?
Yes, my bowel movement is normal in the morning, but let's say if I go for breakfast, and then I have breakfast so like 2 hours later, and then right within an hour after that, after having you know, like a bagel, like I say, or a cheese omelet, then I'm looking for the bathroom within an hour. And
Right. So, I mean, it definitely does sound like a lactose intolerance. In this scenario, I would probably recommend, you know, trying a day with no dairy and seeing how your bowel movements are. A lot of times patients who want to have, you know, cheese or a bowl of ice cream, sometimes they'll do an over-the-counter lactaid supplement before they consume dairy. So that might be something to consider here. But I would first try to avoid the dairy in the first place, see if you have the regular bowel movements to see if, you know, that's what, you know, your symptoms are from. And if that's established, then try the lactate supplements.
Hank, thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Susan in Goshen. Susan, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a quick question on the home test versus colonoscopy. I'm 66. I've had four colonoscopies. I have diverticulitis, which I have pretty well contained at this point and rarely get a flare-up. And I feel like going in for another colonoscopy is just invasive. Could I do in replacement of that, since we've never found any colon cancer, just to get the home test instead of a colonoscopy?
Right. So now they have the newer Cologuard test, which tests, you know, the stool sample for, you know, DNA cells and also blood. It's a very comprehensive test that is good for the average risk patient who otherwise would not be considered high risk, you know, no personal history of inflammatory bowel disease, no personal history of, you know, concerning polyps that were removed at previous colonoscopies. So the Cologuard can be a helpful test. However, it's not as accurate, of course, as direct visualization with a colonoscopy. So even if a Cologuard comes back negative, there is a potential for a false negative. But, you know, if you do the Cologuard in combination with, you know, not having any of those alarm symptoms that we discussed earlier as far as, you know, blood in the stool, unintentional weight loss, and if there's no significant family history and, you know, first-degree relative especially, then the Cologuard could be a good option.
Yeah, because when you have diverticulitis, is it good to get a lot of colonoscopies? This would be my fifth. And I just feel like maybe I shouldn't be poking around so much. Or does it not matter?
I mean, the test
would be just easier. Yeah.
Right. So I just want to clarify. So diverticulosis is you know, a very benign condition of the colon where over time you have these benign outpouchings of the colon wall. They're almost like small little hernias in the colon wall. And sometimes those can get infected, and that's when you would develop diverticulitis. So just to clarify, have you been diagnosed with diverticulitis, which is an infection of the colon of the diverticula, was it just
a few times?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
the guideline for that.
Yeah.
Okay. So the guideline for that is if you've not had a colonoscopy after being diagnosed with a diverticulitis, then you would need to get a colonoscopy.
All right.
So I'm not sure when your most recent diverticulitis flare was, but the most recent guidelines do recommend an actual colonoscopy if you've had diverticulitis and did not have a colonoscopy afterwards.
Susan, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Noor Parsa joins us from Albany Medical Center today, and we go to Oneonta. Gail, you're on.
Hi. I'm 77 years old, and I've had colonoscopy or after 75, and I had precancerous polyps, and another gastroenterologist says, oh, yes, you can have those until you're 85. What's your take on that?
Okay. Sorry, you cut off there a little bit, so I just want to sort of summarize what I heard. So you said you're currently 75 years old?
76 now. And I've
you're
heard
76.
That after 75, you don't have, even though I had precancerous polyps.
Okay.
I've wondered.
So at what age to stop the colonoscopies, basically?
So generally, the colonoscopies are recommended from age 45 up to age 75. So after 75, it's sort of on a case-by-case scenario as far as, you know, your history of polyps, how frequently you need to return for surveillance colonoscopy. So, you know, it's no longer considered screening. It's more surveillance because you have a known history of colon polyps. And depending on what kind of polyps they were, from there we could recommend, you know, as far as how frequent you would need to come and do those colonoscopies. Generally, after the age of 85, even, you know, with a history of polyps, there is no, like, general agreement for continuing colonoscopy surveillance.
Gail, thank you very much for the call. And we go to Michael in Woodstock. Michael, you're on. Hiya, Michael.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I have been diagnosed with, I've been diagnosed with Barrett's syndrome in my esophagus, and I've been recommended that I take Perazole. My question is, I've been told that if I take it now, I'm going to have to take it for life, and yet in doing my own research, because the Barrett's can turn cancerous, I understand. But I understand there's a danger in taking that drug on a long-term arrangement that can cause stomach cancer. Does any of this make sense?
Okay, Michael, your connection is terrible, so we're going to turn you down, but we'll let Dr. Answer, and then we'll bring you back up if needed.
Okay, so I think I got most of that. My understanding was this gentleman has a history of Barrett's esophagus and is on omeprazole therapy, if I heard the medication correctly, and he's concerned about the side effects of omeprazole.
I'm not sure. Michael, was that the medication you were speaking of?
Yes, that's it. And the concern is, I've been told to take it long-term, and there seems to be a danger of cancer, stomach cancer, if you do it long-term.
Gotcha. Okay, doctor.
Okay. So generally, there's been a lot of research fear about the class of medication known as proton pump inhibitors, which omeprazole falls under. So as far as the Barrett's esophagus, so that's thought to be caused by uncontrolled acid reflux, and that's probably why you are recommended to be on medication to control the acid reflux to prevent, further changes in the cells of your distal esophagus from chronic exposure to acid. As far as the medication, typically patients who are on very high doses for years and years and years may develop certain side effects. It's very rare, however, and you would have to be on very high doses for a very long period of time. So, in this case, it's sort of a balancing act where, you know, you have the Barrett's esophagus, which needs to be continuously monitored based on what was seen at your most recent routine surveillance upper endoscopy. But acid control is key here, and the risk of the Barrett's forming into a cancer of the distal esophagus versus the risk of an adverse effect from the omeprazole is a balancing act per se, but I believe that being on the omeprazole would outweigh the risks of any of the side effects from the medication.
Michael, thank you very much for the call. What are, briefly, some of the possible side effects from omeprazole?
So omeprazole specifically has been linked to, chronic kidney disease. Overall, PPIs have been linked to anything from stroke to pneumonia. So there's a whole spectrum of side effects that have been linked to proton pump inhibitors. But again, they're very rare, and patients usually have to be on very high doses for a prolonged period of time for that to really, surface as a potential side effect.
We're joined today by Dr. Noor Parsa of Albany Medical Center, and only a little less than 3 minutes left here, so let's go to Diane in Pine Plains. Diane, you're on. Hello.
Hi, I just had to unmute. I had a question. I would like to know what your opinion is of something called leaky gut syndrome, which I was told 30 years ago I have. And, some doctors, my rheumatologist doesn't really consider it a factor. So I know you're mostly surgery and whatever, but I wanted to know if you had an opinion on that.
Leaky gut syndrome. Okay.
And I'm sorry, you said that you were diagnosed with leaky gut syndrome?
Yes, I was told 30 years ago, and I did some elimination diets. I ate clay for a while. I did all sorts of things, and my RA, my version of RA, did not seem to get better, so I just kind of dismissed it. But this is 30-odd years later, and I've been taking NSAIDs all that time. And then I read somewhere where, it could damage your gut and that it could be involved in inflammation, which, of course, the
right
arthritis is. So I was
right.
Just wondering, I mentioned it to my rheumatologist, and she's very supportive of some things like turmeric and fish oil and things, but she did not seem to feel any concern for the NSAIDs going through my gut or damaging
okay.
my gut.
Yeah. So with leaky gut, the thought process is that like at the microscopic level, there's inflammation and, changes to the gut flora or the normal bacteria. And that can lead to symptoms of loose stools or malabsorption. And, generally, the thought process is that NSAIDs could contribute to leaky gut. I think in this case, it's a bit challenging because, you said that you are currently taking NSAIDs and you ran it by your rheumatologist, but she doesn't believe that it could be causing your symptoms. Is that correct?
She didn't consider it. Sorry.
Okay. We only have about 20 seconds here.
That it was contributing. She was kind of just. I took myself off of NSAIDs.
Okay.
I mean, I've done it periodically.
Okay, so you're not on it anymore.
I've been off for 2 months, and
okay.
I feel a lot better.
We're almost out of time, so let's let Dr. Parsa bring it home.
Okay. So that's a great question. I think it would be something that would need to be further investigated in clinic, seeing your gastroenterologist. NSAIDs can potentially cause or be related to the leaky gut, but it would be something that we would need to further investigate on a face-to-face basis.
Well, Dr. Noor Parsa, you have done splendidly. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll talk to you soon. Support comes from Nathan LaTower Hospital, announcing Quick and Sick Urgent Care Program. Walk in and same-day appointments. Open 7 days, nlh.org for appointments. Once again, thanks to Dr. Noor Parsa of Albany Medical Center for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for the calls, the very detailed calls. And sorry if we didn't get to yours. We'll do this one again soon. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Joe Makowicz took the calls. And our producer's Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, you really can't complain about the weather today. It looks like it's going to be about 50 tomorrow, so I will not be able to complain. This annoys me because Jason Goff is here, and we're going to talk about weather. Ordinarily, I like to complain when Jason's here, but, we'll find something to complain about. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m., Weather with Jason Goff. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.